The Baltimore Symphony Orchestra and Concert Artists of Baltimore Symphonic Chorale are presenting Handel's Messiah in Baltimore and the Washington area, December 2nd through the 4th. And with me in the studio to talk about the performances is Maestro Edward Polacek, who will be conducting. Welcome back.
Well, it's always so great to be here. I'll tell you, it's like coming back home. I just love it, Diana.
And we love having you. So your Messiah stands out from most conductors' interpretations in so many ways, but I think one very important one is that with the BSO, you do the whole piece.
That was a kind of a stipulation of mine when I was sitting here thinking, how long have we been doing this? Since 1982, I remember it was when the Joseph Meyerhoff Symphony Hall first opened. Mm-hmm. I began the annual performances of Messiah at Baltimore Symphony. Although it has changed in some directions over the years, it's pretty much the same compilation of arias, choruses, and recitatives that Handel had originally thought, or up through the years had put together as what he thought of as a complete work. And I've been doing it the same way since 1982. It's an amazing, absolutely amazing piece of music, because when you consider that Handel wrote it in just under 3 weeks, you know, it was, I think, 20 days total, in one of his incredibly manic phases, and Handel was also one who knew his Bible extremely well, so with the help of Jennings, his librettist, they put together this amazing work, which in itself stands out as one of the most unusual oratorios that Handel ever wrote. When you think about Messiah, and you have four soloists, they are labeled as soprano, alto, tenor, bass. They are not literally characters. They don't have actual names. They may sometimes take the role of a character, and sometimes they take the role of a Greek chorus, but they are not the usual characters that you would see in the others of Handel's oratorios throughout. You know, I don't know how many he wrote in total, but I think it's well over 30. So Messiah, I think Handel felt, was going to be an unusual piece of music, an unusual, in a certain sense, an unusual piece that was going to save him. He needed a hit, which he was not getting. Now, Handel, a German who, by way of Italy, comes to England, and we think of him mostly as an English composer, but he had a lot of training in Germany, and his favorite love actually was Italian opera, Baroque opera. And he brings all of this over to London and continues to write Italian opera, not terribly successfully. Oratorio, yes. Many of his instrumental works, as we know, like the water music and the royal fireworks, very successful. Concerti Grosso and the organ concerti, fabulously successful. He comes to a point in his career where he really needs a hit, and he comes up with the idea of Messiah. And he writes this piece that overnight was just, of course, an immediate sensation. Unlike so many of the other great works that we know of, like the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto or whatever, that the list goes on, that of great works nowadays that really were not overnight sensations. And he added to it and altered it over the years. We know we have the Foundling Hospital version. We have the 1740 in the various 40s through many of years in the 1740s that he wrote different versions and added an aria here for a special soloist or a duet there for two soloists that he liked. But the piece itself was pretty much the way he had written it. And the reason I give all this background on this piece is because you have to realize that it was written in a tremendous hurry. The score for me was really a skeleton, and you had to then dig way underneath the skin of that skeleton, if there is skin on a skeleton, and try to find out really what was going on here and the implications that he had, either by key relationships, tempo relationships, and text. And in finding that out, I uncovered something that was, for me, the biggest revelation of all, and that was that, like many Baroque composers, he wrote in suites, and they are connected by text and by key and by tempo relationships. And so you have to put these together in a grouping of a suite, and it's nonstop until you get to the end of that particular suite, and then you take a little break of at least maybe 10 seconds. Not long. You know me. I don't stop for, I wait for no man or woman. We go on, and then you go into the next suite. And it binds the entire piece together in one of the most beautiful, amazing, wonderfully and breathtakingly dramatic pieces of music that has ever been written.
You have mentioned in rehearsal a number of times. I've sung this piece with you many times. I'm singing this year, actually. Yes. And you've mentioned that this is an opera, in fact. You mentioned Handel's love for opera.
Exactly.
So that makes perfect sense.
Sure. And although he channeled a lot of his feelings about opera into oratorio, because during the season of Lent in England, with the Church of England said you cannot have opera. So they went into unstaged opera and wrote oratorio. And that gave the audiences their kind of operatic fix, as it were, for opera. But he never stopped writing Italian Baroque opera. And the traditions and the conventions that were dictated by Italian opera were one of great floridity. The ornamentation is off the charts.
Yes.
And so I pull that part of Handel into Messiah. And not only the soloists, but the instrumentalists and the choruses, as you know, get ornamentation. They're, everything is embellished. And it makes sense to me because it is so skeletally written. It's very, very stark. And I know I've heard a million performances that are performed that way, but he never meant it to be that way. I know from my reading about him, from my research about the way he would ornament, and there is some documentation that he actually wrote out for a soprano in one of his Italian operas, and it might have been Alcina, but I'm not sure of that. But there are three arias that were published where he wrote the ornamentation for the soprano because she was not versed in Italian ornamentation. And I want to tell you, he embellishes so it's unrecognizable. So it gave me a great deal of courage and somewhat leeway, the freedom to go forward with all of that kind of, bringing all of that beauty of embellishment and ornamentation into Messiah.
Speaking of ornamentation, you conduct this piece from the harpsichord, yes. And you provide some ornamentation from the keyboard as well. Some funny stuff, in places.
It is, and I think that there's that humor should never, ever be lacking and never be overlooked. All composers, even the most serious of them, had a tremendous sense of humor in their music and outside of their music. So, yes, I do have some fun with it, and I have to be careful not to overdo it, but I get sometimes a little bit carried away, and I get inspired by it. It never, ever, ever gets old for me. And I must say that the Baltimore Symphony and Concert Artists of Baltimore, our professional chorus and our symphonic chorale, which of course are many of the old former members of the Baltimore Symphony Chorus who have come together that sing this and have sung it year after year after year, we all tend to feel the same way. And it's very interesting to me to watch soloists who come in from the outside. And I can see it in their eyes when I'm coaching. Oh, yeah, he wants this. Okay, no problem. Yeah, he wants. Okay, well, I'll do it. Yeah. And because we've done it for so many years, we never get a dress rehearsal. I have literally three normal size, normal length rehearsals. One with orchestra alone, just to refresh it. We have our chorus rehearsals that lead up to one orchestra dress with chorus and orchestra alone, and one soloist rehearsal with soloist and orchestra alone. Never does it get run through until the first night of performance. And the revelation that I see in the eyes of the soloists is, to me, it's staggering. It's so much fun. Their eyes just pop. Even an old war horse like the Hallelujah Chorus gets a fresh outlook in its performance.
It really does. And I have to say the chorus enjoys watching the soloist reactions too. We have a good time with that. Yes, we do. Yeah. So your interpretation of Messiah obviously comes from a lot of research, many years of research. Does some of it also come from maybe having heard Messiah and going, wow, that's not the way I want to do it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it does. It comes from a lot of exposure early on in my life of listening to recordings and live performances of Messiah. It comes also from one of my mentors from many years ago when I was in Philadelphia in the early 70s. I worked with a tremendous conductor and choral director. His name was Michael Korn. He's since passed. Watching his approach to chorus, to orchestra, and to, in particular, Messiah. And I thought, this man gets it. This is somebody that I want to be connected with. And I ended up, of course, studying with him and became his assistant for many years while I was there. He was the one who really kind of opened doors for me. And once I walked through those doors, it was really, I reached a point of no return. And it just, in a certain sense, the way we, and I say we, you, Diana, who have sung it with me for many years and are singing it this year, the way we as a chorus, we as an orchestra, we as soloist, and myself as the keyboard. I do not want to shortchange James Harp, who is on the organ continuum, because I use organ for the choruses and harpsichord for the soloists. But what we have done over the years has been a true evolution of a magnificent masterpiece of music. And that's what makes it very special.
What are some notable changes that you've made over the years? Are there anything, anything that comes to mind?
I would say after doing it for many, many years in the 80s and into the 90s, I realized that the very, very opening, some people call it a symphonia or an overture before the tenor gets up to sing his Comfort Ye and Every Valley, that opening, I realized that slow opening was really a kind of French overture. It was in the style of a French overture. And I thought, well, you don't just, when you repeat it, you don't just play that again that way. So I gave the concertmaster, I wrote out a whole bunch of ornaments, and I know that it raised many eyebrows. And they've now, when Jonathan Carney does it, he has kind of made it his own. And I think it's brilliant. So with all of these, on the repeat of that slow opening, people will hear something very, very special. We then go through, because there's not much you can do with the fast part, the Allegro con brio part, but we add a lot of ornaments and a lot of trills and a lot of appoggiaturas and a lot of short notes and a few changed notes that I felt harmonically were what Handel would have done. The secret, I think, and because people say, oh my God, your Messiah is so fast. The secret is not really the tempi, although that's part of it, of course. And I think my fast tempi are on the brisker side, not unusual for a lot of conductors nowadays, but a lot of my slower tempi are on the slower side. I think the secret is figuring out those suites, those Baroque suites, and going attaccas from one to the next, no let up, because that drama doesn't stop. So the music just really points out the importance of that drama by leaving you somewhat breathless, and that's what I love about it, our Messiah.
There are some things that we as singers do vocally in this piece, and some of them are sort of common. People who don't sing may not be aware that classical singers will change the pronunciation mm-hmm. of a word quite a bit, whether it's in English or another language, mm-hmm. To make it sound musical. There are some pronunciations that are frankly just ugly if you sing them.
And try to make them sound that way. That's one of the unique characters about the voice. I mean, if you're playing violin, whether you're on the low G string or up in the stratosphere in 2 millionth position on the E string, you're pretty much the same way of approach in terms of the sound that you want, whether it's loud, soft, fast, slow, that kind of thing. With the voice, you have to do modification with vowels, which is going to change from a very low register into the middle register of the voice, and certainly, most importantly, in the upper register, where vowels will change. And I encourage this, I suggest it when we're working with the chorus, how things have to change. And also from a diction point of view, some summer or some year, perhaps I'll take a part of a sabbatical. I really would love to do our own edition of it and do all of that editing that the chorus does. I think people would be, pretty much amazed by seeing it on paper, the way we change words in order to make to allow the listener, the audience, hear what we think Handel had in mind, to homogenize it to a certain extent. And one of my favorite choruses of doing that is Lift Up Your Heads, number 33, because I actually, as you know, when we get into the Lord of Hosts, I have to change it for some some voice parts, and the chorus will end up singing, for example, the stoat of hosts, or the stoat of ho he is, or there are just so many different kinds of things that if you put it together or just look at it on paper, they would think this man has lost his mind. But when you put it together and everybody does it at exactly the same time, it clarifies the diction so that it's actually understandable for the audience, for the listener.
There are some things that we do that don't involve words, too, right. Like Since by Man Came Death, holding the scores up in front of our faces,
right.
Beneath the nose, obviously. Well, we have to be able to see you.
Yeah, exactly. That's one instance. Another one, and this is one of my favorites, is the Glory to God chorus, number 17, in the first act. Now, and here's how I came up with this. I thought Handel marks certain of the instrumental parts. I don't think he puts anything in the chorus parts, but I think he marks the instrumental parts forte. But in the trumpet parts, he says da lontano, as from afar. So you have to think now, backing up, the soprano, who is somewhat a narrator and sometimes the angel itself or herself, leads you into the idea that there were shepherds abiding in the field, you know, keeping watch over their flock by night, and tells the story about while they were watching their flocks, this multitude of the heavenly host comes out of the sky. And of course, she says, fear not. I always like to have that done extremely gently. Most people say, because it's in quotes, fear not, you know, and I thought, you know, these poor shepherds are scared enough. You don't have to scream it at them. But, you know, and then she comes around and she says, and suddenly there was with the angel a multitude of the heavenly host praising God and saying, what they have to say is really from afar. It's really from over the mountainside. So I ask everybody to bring the scores up over your mouth so that it sounds like it's from afar. And I even have the trumpets off stage. Da lontano. And everybody is very, very soft, except for the violins, who are also soft, but they're the fluttering of the angel wings going, and the chorus from almost like from off stage says, glory to God. And I just love it. And then we make that crescendo, right?
Mm-hmm.
Into up to about letter C, where all of a sudden the chorus stands up, the books are down in front, and the whole heavenly host sings, glory to God at the highest. I find it a very dramatic moment.
I do too. I always have.
We're giving our secrets away here.
Yes, we are. But I think people will enjoy that.
Yeah, I think that they become overwhelmed by it. And it brings a whole new sense of drama to the piece.
I agree.
And the operatic quality of it. And why it's not a static piece of music by any means. At the end of that chorus, too, I just have the strings drop out one by one so that it's only like two or three players at the very end, that last little fluttering of angel wing that goes back up into the heavens. I just get such a kick. And there are a myriad of examples of like that in the score. A myriad. It's phenomenally brilliant. I cannot even begin to tell you the scope or the extent of the genius of that piece of music. That's why I get so excited about it. And that's why the audience gets excited about it too.
So you're obviously in love with Messiah, except with perhaps one chorus.
You know me too well, Diana.
Yes, I do. And a lot of recordings, again, just treat this as sort of a blow-off. It's the Lord gave the word, number 37, I believe.
It is.
And you do things with it in performance that are tremendously comic, from a chorister's standpoint anyway.
Well, it is actually comic. And this particular chorus, I look at it as, to a certain extent, Handel's mocking of the, let's say, the pomposity of the clergy. And so I take it just probably to the extreme. So in the very, very beginning, rather than having a chord, a B-flat major chord on the downbeat, I have mainly the contrabassoon on the lowest note as a buzzing, gurgling note going on that low B flat. It's magnificent. And then, you know, we state the Lord gave the word. It occurred to me actually many years after I had been doing the piece that this really is full of pomposity, because Handel, and it's right there in the score, that, you know, people say, oh, how did you ever think of this? I say, I didn't think of anything. Handel thought of it. You just have to dig out the clues but he gives them to you. It's one of the most static pieces of music in the entire piece. it doesn't really move much further from B flat. You'll get, I mean, tonic out the wazoo. It's just is nothing but tonic. And then you get a little bit of a dominant, you know, so, but basically B flat major, a little bit of F major, B flat major, B flat major, B flat major. So I thought, I guess what it's supposed to be is this unending procession of clergy down the aisle, that like, when is this going to end? So it just got slower and slower over the years. I heard last year a recording that we had done, I don't know, I think it was about 15 years ago, and I was amazed at how fast I had done it. It has slowed down. It's almost in 8. It's not even in 4 anymore. It's just so slow. And it is comical. It is a mocking kind of what that was about. And I could see Handel smiling like, somebody figured that out. Somebody got it. I get tired of it because it's so slow and lugubrious, but it's a great moment, actually.
I think it is dramatically unmusical.
Right.
Well, one of the most exciting aspects of this year's performances is that we are making a recording of Messiah for Naxos. The Friday and Sunday performances at the Meyerhof here in Baltimore are being recorded.
That's correct. That's correct. And I'm very excited about this. I have to say that this was, first of all, this has been a dream of mine come true after many decades of doing this piece. Many of us have said, oh, you know, we have to record it. And we all agreed, yes, it should be recorded. Yes, it should be recorded. I mentioned this to a friend of mine last year, and he said, then let's get it done. His name is Rick Bernstein. Now, he is the son of Lorraine and Mac Bernstein, who are dear, 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 dear friends of mine who have passed away several years ago. Lorraine was one of the executors of the Peggy Neal Gordon Charitable Trust. And Rick and his brothers have had become, over the years, big supporters of Concert Artists of Baltimore. And now Rick sits on the board of the Baltimore Symphony. And it's really through the generosity of the Bernstein family that this recording is made possible. So I'm ultimately grateful to all of the Bernstein family, and I thank them, and I, over the airwaves, give them virtual hugs, each and every one of them individually. This now will commit our interpretation, which I think is a very special interpretation, and the energy that is given by the chorus and the orchestra, because I cannot imagine doing this really anywhere else in the world except with Baltimore Symphony and Concert Artists Symphonic Chorale. I don't think anybody else is capable of doing it the way we're doing it. And that's partly the evolution of this. But it will commit to posterity now our version of what we think Handel really had in mind for this great masterpiece. We're actually doing 3 performances, Friday night, 7:30 at Meyerhof Hall. Saturday, we take it down to Strathmore Hall in Bethesda, also at 7:30. And then Sunday afternoon, 3 o'clock, back at Meyerhof. And then afterwards, we do a patch session with Naxos to, if there are any aberrations that we might have missed during the live performances, we'll fix them. I find this a very, very exciting time. I mean, how many recordings are there out there of Messiah? Probably more than just about any other work. I would think even more than Vivaldi's 4 Seasons.
I would think they'd be neck and neck. At least, yes.
At least, right? I think it's probably one of the most popular pieces ever written, right? So I think, you know, and everybody has their interpretation, but mm-hmm. I really do think that we're going to turn some heads, well, turn some ears with this recording. And I'm very humbled by the opportunity to be able to do this. I'm very, very thankful, very appreciative.
And I'm thrilled to once again be on stage with you doing this.
Thank you. And the feeling is mutual, my dear.
Thank you. Well, this is Handel's Messiah being presented by the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra and Concert Artists of Baltimore. Symphonic Chorale. My guest, Maestro Edward Polacek, will be conducting December 2nd through the 4th at both the Meyerhof and Strathmore. And information about tickets is available at bsomusic.org. Maestro Edward Polacek, thank you so much for coming in to talk with me today.
It is such a great pleasure and a privilege. Thank you so much.
For WBJC, I'm Diana Neal.